I'm speaking today with Tom Gray, who is the Director of Communications for the American Wind Energy Association here in Houston for the Wind Power 08 conference. And the first question I have, just very generally, is, you know, tell me a little bit about the state of the wind energy industry in America and in Texas.
Well, the state of the wind energy industry in America, Texas, and the world is a very positive one. We've gone through a long twilight period between we had a false dawn in California in the early 1980s, and then since then it's been pretty slow going up until 1999. Now we're on the upswing and we're seeing tremendous growth both in Texas, in the U.S., and around the world in wind power.
To what would you attribute that upswing that started in 99?
Well, I think we have an incentive, the production tax credit at the federal level, and it was passed in 1992, but it was not scheduled to expire until June 30, 1999. And about a year before it was scheduled to expire, all of a sudden projects started getting built. So it was as if folks looked around and said, hey, there's this incentive here. If we're going to use it, we should take advantage of it now. And then they started looking more seriously at the technology, and I think it really flows from that.
Was it existing energy companies that mostly moved into that, or was it more fueled by new entrepreneurs?
It was, I'd say, a combination of the two. There was an existing industry in California. Some of the companies that were involved in that industry are still involved in it today, but then some new players came into the field too as the industry started growing, and it became clear that there was some significant potential in this energy source. Of course, new companies entered the field.
Now, right now, how much of the U.S. energy is attributable to wind energy? What's the share of the production?
Wind generates at the moment, or this year, will generate a little over 1% of the electricity in the U.S.
And what's the, you know, say the 10 or 20 year projected growth?
Well, we just, the U.S. Department of Energy just published a report about 3 weeks ago, which had looked at the possibility of deriving 20% of U.S. electricity supply from wind by the year 2030, and concluded that yes, there are no apparent obstacles that would prevent that from happening. So that's about as much electricity as nuclear power supplies today, or as natural gas supplies today. So it would mean a substantial increase in the wind energy supply.
What sources of energy would you say wind energy is likely to displace as it grows, or do you see it as more meeting the demand for new growth?
Well, it's not a particularly good tool for meeting new growth, because it is variable, and as we all know, sometimes the wind doesn't blow, and when that is the case, there has to be other power capacity available. What it is excellent at is generating electricity, and when it generates electricity, reducing emissions of the power system, because everything it generates has no emissions. It's also really good at reducing fuel price spikes, because there's no fuel. And so the more you've got of this energy source that has no fuel as part of your portfolio of generating sources, the more stable your electricity prices should be.
Now, in Texas, the wind industry has been growing greatly. In fact, I believe Texas is now overtaken, or is about to overtake, California as the nation's largest producer of wind energy.
It's number one.
Okay. What makes Texas a good place for wind energy?
Well, there is a renewable portfolio standard in this state. It was one of the earlier ones in the United States, and it required utilities to obtain a certain amount of their electricity, a certain percentage of their electricity from renewable sources during a certain time frame. And that led to some development. Texas has excellent wind resources. If you look at the map of the United States, the whole central part of the U.S. is pretty windy. And if you look and you say, okay, well, where do you have wind that's relatively near to cities? Texas is one area. Iowa and Minnesota are another area, and there's been a lot of wind development there also. So I think it's a combination of geographical factors and favorable legislation.
Now, as I understand it, Texas has a lot of wind farms out in the western part of the state. There was a recent news article saying that while all that capability exists out there, the infrastructure to deliver the power to the more populated part of the states isn't there, and that it would require a fairly sizable investment. Can you tell me more about that?
It does require investment. One of the problems that we have, you think of the ability to put a power plant in really quickly as an advantage, but in fact, when you consider that it takes quite a while to plan, site, and build a new transmission line, there's a mismatch between the speed with which wind can be developed and the speed with which transmission is normally developed. And so we're in a situation at the moment where wind has kind of outstripped the transmission capability. There is new transmission being planned. Once it's in place, the fuel savings that will result from using wind should relatively quickly recover the cost of any new transmission that would be required. So it should be a problem that resolves itself. This is something we've seen before. There have been places where transmission has not been available, and then once it becomes available, everything gets straightened out.
So who's investing in the transmission lines? Is that mostly the private industry, or is that more of government responsibility?
That's a good question. I think Texas has a program called CREZ, the Competitive Renewable Energy Zones. This that is a program that was developed in response to this whole problem of you can't build the lines until the generation is there, and you can't build the generation unless the lines are there. And so under this program, renewable energy zones are identified. The state pays for the transmission and then recovers the cost from the generation projects that get built there. And of course, during that process, there's time for negotiation, so you have pretty good assurance from the developers who want to build the projects that the projects are actually going to go up.
What time frame do you see for the transmission capability matching the generation capability?
That I'm not really up to speed on the exact timetable. So I would guess it would be in the next 3 to 5 years, but I'm not positive.
Okay.
Maybe sooner.
As you know, there's a big lawsuit going on in Texas between basically the King Ranch and a coalition of environmentalists and the Kennedy Ranch over the Kennedy Ranch's desire to build wind generation plants on its property. There's a couple of issues involved here, but one that I will ask about is claims by the plaintiff, including the environmental group, that the location of the Kennedy plant being off the coast would have a negative impact on migratory birds.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned previously that the state of California had kind of a false dawn on wind energy in the 80s, and I presume that's a reference to the Altamont plants. What impact in general do wind plants have on birds, and how can this be how can you measure it for a new plant to determine what that impact will be?
Well, first of all, let me step back a second and say what caused the false dawn in California was another federal incentive that was scheduled to expire in 1985, an investment tax credit in wind plants. And it did expire on time, just as we predicted. The wind industry collapsed because it had been strongly stimulated by this credit that at that time was based on just investing in plants, whether they produced anything or not. And so a lot of equipment that didn't operate very good was built as a result of that. The one we have now is a production tax credit. You only get paid for the electricity that you produce in proportionate to the electricity that you produce. It really was a kind of a separate issue. There has been an issue with the birds in Altamont Pass. In general, though, at sites around the U.S., and there have been studies done at a number of sites, and they haven't found anything, any serious issues. The one in Altamont is an area with very high year-round raptor use, and it also has 5,000 turbines. The estimate has been that 1,000 to 4,000 birds are killed a year. If you do the math, clearly it's a one bird per turbine or less. So it's not a huge thing, but nevertheless, raptors seem to be particularly vulnerable, and that's something that people are concerned about. Broadly across the nation, wind plants we estimate kill perhaps one of every 10,000 birds that die through human activity, from cats, from pesticides, from flying into buildings, into automobiles. There are a whole range of other sources that are orders of magnitude larger than wind turbines. Even if we got all of our electricity from wind, we'd still only be a relatively small fraction of human-related avian mortality.
What safeguards can be put in place to minimize that mortality?
Well, the best thing that that you can do, that we've found to do, in my opinion, is do some avian studies, see what the behavior of the birds is in the area, and try to understand what the birds are using the area for, and then based on that, you can determine what locations are good ones for sighting. That's, there are lots of other innovative things that have been suggested, radio signals and noises and all sorts of things, but careful sighting seems to be the best approach.
Are there accepted standards, and by accepted I mean not just by industry but also by environmentalists, for things like the methodology of such a study and what's a quote-unquote acceptable level of mortality and things like that?
Not really. That's still under debate, To be honest, what it boils down to is if you're a developer, you look at a site and you say, okay, just how risky do I think this is? And I know some developers that have told me privately, yes, we have walked away from locations that, were reasonably windy sites because there was an endangered species close enough to it that we just thought we better not go there. But it's not something that we have. There are accepted standards for measuring the activity at a site, but then what constitutes whether it's okay to build there or not? That I think is, there's always going to be some debate over that. I should just add, we have been engaged for a number of years now in an active program of collaborating with environmental groups and government agencies and others on birds, on bats, and on prairie chicken, prairie grouse, to try to understand the impacts and to figure out better ways of dealing with them. So that is a key part of our effort, is to engage with groups that are concerned about these things, talk with them, try to come to some agreement on what can be done.
Another aspect of this litigation is a dispute over whether or not the wind farm needs to follow federal or state guidelines for its construction. And without getting into the specifics there, the question that I have is, the state of Texas doesn't really seem to have a permitting process, at least for wind farms that are proposed on private land, for the construction of wind farms, whereas of course there's all kinds of permitting processes for other forms of utility construction. Mm-hmm. Broadly speaking, what sort of process should there be to allow for public feedback for a proposed wind farm? I mean, presumably, in addition to questions about birds, there are other, one of the things that has been brought up in this lawsuit is questions about noise. Mm-hmm. So what should be the process?
Well, typically, in many states, there are not specific noise standards, but it's handled through a nuisance. You know, if you're creating a problem, then you've got to modify. You know, the authorities will investigate, and they will, you know, you'll have to sit down with the people that are complaining about the noise and figure out what's going to be done about it.
That's reactive rather than proactive, though, and that kind of puts the burden on the people who claim to be affected.
Well, it does to a degree, but what I think we've found, and what anybody that studies this stuff finds, is people vary pretty widely in terms of the degree to which something, a noise bothers them, or a sound bothers them. And so to have to build everything to the most restrictive standards is probably not the best way to go either. What there are federal standards that we have to adhere to, though. Wetland, if there's a wetland, or, you know, there flight safety regulations, there are a variety of laws that we do have to comply with. In the avian area, that's an area of some debate, because the federal guidelines that were developed without any industry input, and in some cases they've picked up a problem that occurred in one place and said, oh, okay, well, you know, we won't build in any places like that anywhere. And the fact is that as we've been just discussing, the risk to birds in general from wind projects is pretty low. And so making a blanket rule across the country for some of these things is not wise. There are significant differences between parts of the country, let's say the Southwest and the Northeast, in terms of the vegetation, the habitat, and the frequency with which birds use it, purposes for which they use the land. All of those vary, and there needs to be a little bit more of a recognition of case-by-case differences between the places where wind farms could be built.
Now, you had mentioned that there's a federal tax incentive for building wind farms. Is there not something similar to that here in the state of Texas as well? I believe a property tax abatement?
That may be. I don't know. Sorry, right. I'm not up on that either.
Okay. I guess looking forward, you know, where do you see the wind energy industry in, say, the year 2020?
Well, I think, you know, there are a number of market studies out there, and they're all calling for a substantial growth in the industry, for it to triple in size by 2015, you know, quadruple by 2020. Numbers vary a little bit from study to study, but they all see pretty sharp growth, and it's driven by the things we've been talking about. Global warming is an issue that a lot of folks are concerned about. This is an energy technology that reduces global warming emissions. Fuel price costs is pretty much on everybody's mind lately. We don't just have a problem with the price of oil and gasoline. We have a problem with the price of natural gas, which is very important to our country's energy future. It's one of the lowest carbon emitting of the fossil fuels. The price at the moment is creating a problem. So again, the wind fits very well. When the wind's blowing, you can turn the natural gas plants down, save a lot of fuel. So for those reasons, not just here but around the world, I mean, the price of natural gas is not just a U.S. problem. It's an international problem. And so Spain is in a very similar situation with Texas. It's got a lot of gas. It's got a demand that's about the same size, and it's got a lot of windy land, and they're installing wind plants pretty much about as fast as they can build them. And they have just about as much installed in Spain, it's about the size of Texas, as there are in the whole U.S., and they're building more.
What about other renewable sources of energy like solar or geothermal? Texas is also a pretty good place for those. Is the wind energy industry, does that have any overlap with with those other forms of energy, or is it all basically siloed?
It's pretty siloed. Not for any particular reason. I can recall back in the 80s there were some proposals to mix turbines in Southern California with solar collectors and use the land in between the turbines for solar collectors. But
certainly in West Texas, you would think that would be a natural fit.
But the way that this stuff works is whatever is the most economical gets done. There's been talk about combining wind and natural gas, but if you can make the natural gas plant work, you know, one or the other usually is a drag on the economics, and so you wind up with a single plant. Having said that, I do expect concentrating solar power, these kinds of plants that are being talked about more today in the Southwest, do expect that I think they have a bright future. I think geothermal has a future too. And again, it's driven by the same sorts of things, the desire to generate electricity without significant fuel costs and with no greenhouse emissions.
Finally, again, we've talked about it obviously being capable of generating electricity. Maybe this is a silly question, but what can wind be used for other forms of energy? I mean, obviously, you know, oil is a problem.
Yeah.
Is there any way that any of this can be used? I mean, and then talk blue sky if you have to.
No, absolutely.
I mean, you know, do we foresee it being able to replace other forms of energy?
There's something that's only slightly blue sky, and that's plug-in hybrid autos. I'm sure you've heard about them down here. That would make it possible, and we're talking about substantially increasing the electric component of the fuel of vehicles as compared with the gasoline component. And once you do that, boy, you open up a distinct market for wind because the wind plants could generate electricity, charge automobiles at night. I mean, it creates a certain amount of inherent storage, which increases the reliability of the grid and also provides an opening for a variable energy source like wind. And we would love to see it. I think that would really make it possible for us to have some impact on oil imports and oil prices.
All right. Tom Gray, thank you very much for talking to me today. Appreciate it.
Pleasure.